screens where letters shift and slide. We cut and sew the code, revealing doors we used to hide. Tiny.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
It is great to be here.
I want to start today by asking you to close your eyes for a second. Well, maybe not if you're driving or operating heavy machinery, but, you know, use your imagination.
Okay.
I want you to picture the silhouette of a monkey. Any monkey. A macaque, a baboon, maybe a little squirrel monkey running along a branch. Got it.
I've got it. I'm picturing a macaque, long tail for balance, very distinct profile.
Right. Now, right next to it, picture the silhouette of a human, or even a chimp, or a gorilla. What is the single most obvious glaring difference between those two outlines?
Well, aside from the posture, you know, standing upright versus being on all fours, yeah, it has to be the tail.
Exactly, the tail. Monkeys have them, we don't. Hominoids, that's humans and apes, lost them about 25 million years ago.
A long, long time ago.
And for a long time, this was just viewed as a cosmetic change. You know, we came down from the trees, or we changed how we moved, we just lost the tail.
Right, like it just fell off one day. An evolutionary afterthought.
But when you think about the biology of that, it's actually insane.
It really is. It's not just a cosmetic difference. It's a fundamental alteration of the skeletal structure. I mean, you're talking about changing the number of caudal vertebrae, completely reworking the musculature, and rewiring the nervous system pathways.
It's not just a rope attached to your back.
Not at all. It's an extension of your spine. To lose a tail requires a massive rewrite of the developmental program in the embryo. You don't just drop a limb, you have to stop it from ever starting.
Right. And here is where the mystery has been driving scientists crazy for decades.
Yeah.
Because logic and classical genetics would tell you if you lose a whole body part, you must have lost the genes for it.
That's the intuitive leap.
Or you must have had some massive mutation that just, you know, broke the tail gene beyond repair.
That was the prevailing assumption for a very long time. The architect model of evolution. If you want a different building, you change the blueprints, you delete a section.
So for a long time, geneticists were hunting for these lost genes.
Exactly. They were comparing the human genome to the monkey genome, looking for big deletions or, you know, broken instructions. They thought, surely there is a gene that says build tail and we just deleted it.
But they didn't find them.
No, and that's the kicker. The gene that builds the tail, specifically a gene called TBXT, is still there.
It's still in our DNA right now.
It is, largely intact. We have the blueprint, we have the bricks. We just don't build that particular extension on the house anymore.
That is the hook for today. How do you have the blueprint for a tail, sit on it for 25 million years, and never build a tail? It turns out the difference isn't in the blueprint itself, the DNA sequence, but in how the instructions are read.
Precisely. And the culprit, or the hero, depending on how much you miss having a tail, is what we used to call junk DNA.
Junk DNA.
Specifically, a jumping gene that inserted itself into a developmental gene.
So a piece of genomic junk jumped into a vital gene and convinced the cellular machinery to just skip a page.
That is exactly what happened. It essentially edited the instruction manual without changing the original text, just by changing which paragraphs get read.
And that brings us to the central theme of our deep dive today.
It really does.
Our complexity as humans, our brains, our hearts, our immune systems, doesn't come from having more genes than a worm or a fly.
Not at all.
It comes from our ability to edit the genes we have.
Yeah.
In wildly complex ways.
I love that concept. It's not about how much stuff you have, it's about how you use it. It shifts the view of evolution from an architect who builds new rooms.
As an editor who rearranges the scenes to make a better movie.
That's the perfect analogy, and we are looking at the masterclass in editing today.
Okay, before we unravel how we lost our tails and how we built our brains, we need to give credit where credit is due.
Absolutely. Today we are doing a deep dive into a review article published in the EMBO Journal. It's titled The Splice of Life, How Alternative Splicing Shapes Regulatory and Phenotypic Evolution.
And the authors,
Carissa Emerson Hunter and Yi Xing from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania.
And they've done a lot of heavy lifting here. This isn't just one study.
Oh, no. They've synthesized decades of research to show that this mechanism, alternative splicing, isn't just a side effect of biology. It is a primary engine of evolutionary innovation.
And in doing so, they've really helped to address one of the biggest embarrassments in the history of genomics.
Oh, yes. The C-value enigma.
Which sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel, but I gather it's a scientific problem.
It is a historical puzzle that really humbled the scientific community. Back in the day, before we sequenced the human genome, so pre-2000s, there was this very confident assumption.
Which was?
That organismal complexity must correlate with genome size. Basically, if you are a complex creature like a human, capable of language, math, and, well, building podcasts,
then you must have a massive number of genes.
A huge number.
Yeah.
And if you are a simple creature like a roundworm, you must have very few.
It makes intuitive sense. I mean, a big complex brain needs more instructions than a microscopic worm. You'd expect the manual for a space shuttle to be thicker than the manual for a toaster.
Right. And the estimates for human genes were all over the place. I've seen papers suggesting 100,000, maybe more.
Scientists were placing bets.
Literally. There were betting pools. But then we actually sequenced the genomes, and it was a shock, a real profound shock to the system.
What did we find?
It turns out humans have roughly 19,000 protein coding genes.
19,000? That sounds low.
It felt very low. And then to really rub it in, we sequenced the worm.
And the worm.
The nematode worm Caenorhabditis elegans, which is about a millimeter long and has exactly 959 cells, also has about 19,000 to 20,000 genes.
You're kidding.
I am not.
That is underwhelming. That is actually kind of insulting.
It is very humbling. We are working with the same size parts list as a microscopic worm that lives in the dirt. So the question became, how do you get a human brain, a sophisticated immune system, and a beating four-chambered heart from a worm-sized parts list?
That is the C-value enigma.
That's it. And the answer isn't more genes.
No. The answer lies in regulation.
Exactly. Evolution didn't just add new genes, it changed when and where those genes are used. We've known about this for a while. I mean, think about Darwin's finches.
The birds from the Galapagos with the different beak shapes.
Yes. Their beaks changed shape not because they got new beak genes, but because of changes in the expression levels of a gene called BMP4.
So evolution just turned the volume knob up or down?
It turned the volume knob up or down on that gene, and the beak got thicker or thinner. It's a beautiful example of regulatory evolution.
Okay, so that's volume control. Gene expression. That explains some things. But volume control doesn't explain how you get a totally new function.
Right.
Turning up the volume on a radio doesn't turn it into a TV. And it doesn't explain how you lose a tail while keeping the gene intact.
Exactly. Volume control gene expression is only one layer. It tells you how much protein to make. But to solve the enigma of complexity, we need to look at alternative splicing, or AS. This allows one gene to produce multiple different mRNA isoforms. It allows you to change what protein you're making, not just how much.
Isoforms. That's a key word today.
Yeah.
Let's break down the mechanism for everyone, because if we don't get the mechanics right, the rest of this won't land.
Good idea.
How does this actually work at the molecular level?
Okay, so imagine a gene as a long string of DNA,
yeah.
But it's not a continuous sentence, it's interrupted. It has exons, which are the coding parts, the actual instructions for the protein.
And introns.
And introns, which are non-coding spacers in between.
Like commercials in a TV show.
That's a decent analogy. The introns are the commercials. When the cell copies the DNA into RNA, it makes a pre-mRNA that includes everything, the show and the commercials.
The raw footage.
The raw footage, exactly. Splicing is the process of physically cutting out the commercials, the introns, and pasting the show segments, the exons, together to make the final message.
Okay, that's standard splicing. The cell cleans up the tape, it removes the junk, and keeps the story. What is alternative splicing?
Alternative splicing is when the cell decides to edit the show differently. It gets creative. Maybe in one version, you keep scenes 1, 2, and 3.
The standard version.
Right. But in another version, you keep scene 1, skip scene 2 entirely, and jump straight to scene 3.
So you create a shorter version of the movie.
A shorter and maybe functionally different version. Or maybe you retain a commercial break and treat it like part of the show. That's called intron retention. Or maybe you only use the first half of scene 2. There are all these different ways to mix and match.
So from one original recording, one gene, you get 2 or 3 or 10 different movies.
Precisely. The best analogy I've heard is a Lego set. A gene isn't a pre-built model, it's a box of bricks. If you use all the bricks, maybe you build a car.
The default model on the box.
Exactly. But if you skip the wheels and use the wing pieces instead, that same box builds a plane. If you use the hull pieces, it builds a boat.
Yeah.
One gene, multiple final products.
And these final products, the car, the plane, the boat, those are the isoforms.
Yes. And in humans, this is rampant. I mean, it's not a rare thing. Almost all multi-exon human genes undergo alternative splicing.
all of them.
Pretty much. It creates this incredibly versatile toolkit. It allows a single gene to do one thing in the brain, something else in the liver, and something totally different in the heart just by swapping out exons.
That is just... It's incredibly efficient. It solves the space problem.
Completely.
You don't need a separate gene for every single function. You just need a modular one.
You just need a gene with a lot of optional parts.
But who is making these decisions? Who's the editor in the cutting room?
It's a mix of cis and trans elements. And this distinction is crucial for understanding how evolution works.
Okay, definitions time. Let's start with cis. What does that mean?
Cis refers to the regulatory elements on the RNA itself. Think of these as road signs or traffic lights embedded in the sequence. There are little codes that say cut here, start here, or maybe more subtle sign like slow down, splicing site ahead.
So they're a part of the molecule being spliced.
They're part of the script. The script has notes in the margins. Delete this paragraph. Keep this sentence.
Okay, that makes sense. So what are trans elements?
Trans refers to the factors that come from elsewhere to read those notes. These are proteins called splicing factors. They are part of a big machine called the spliceosome.
They're the drivers of the car.
They are the drivers or the editors who see the sign that says stop and hit the brakes. They float around the nucleus looking for their specific signs to bind to.
So if you want to change the movie, you have two options. You can either change the notes in the script.
That's a cis change, a mutation in the DNA.
Or you can change the editor who is reading them.
A trans change. Evolve the protein machinery itself.
Okay, and evolution uses both.
It uses both strategies, but as we'll see, it really loves tinkering with the notes in the script.
Why is that?
It's easier, it's safer. If you change the editor, you might mess up the editing for every movie in the studio, but if you change the note on one script, you only change that one movie. It's more targeted.
Before we get to the specific examples, which are mind-blowing, by the way, I want to ask about how we even know this, because for a long time, we were just guessing, right?
We were, to some extent. We knew splicing happened, but we couldn't see it in detail. We were limited by our tools.
This is the technological evolution part of our story.
Yes. For about 15 years, the gold standard was short read RNA sequencing, mostly on Illumina platforms.
This is what most people think of when they hear genome sequencing.
Mm.
High throughput, very accurate, widely used.
Right. It's incredibly accurate, but it reads short chunks, 50 to 200 base pairs.
Why is that a problem for splicing? If you have the sequence, you have the sequence.
Imagine you take a book or gene and you shred it into confetti.
Okay.
You can read every individual piece of confetti perfectly. You can see the word the and the word cat. But if you're trying to figure out if the sentence was the cat sat on the mat or the cat ate the rat, and those words are on different pieces of confetti,
you have a hard time reconstructing the full sentence.
A very hard time. You lose the connectivity. You can't tell which exons were linked together. You know exon A is in the mix and exon B is in the mix, but are they in the same molecule? In the same isoform.
You can't see the long-range coupling, as the paper calls it.
Exactly. You might infer it statistically, but you can't prove it. You can see the ingredients, but not the final recipe.
So what changed? What was the breakthrough?
Long-read sequencing. Technologies like Oxford Nanopore and Pacific Biosciences. These machines don't shred the book.
What do they do?
They thread the DNA or RNA through a tiny pore, literally a nanopore, and read the whole chapter at once. They can generate reads spanning more than 10,000 base pairs.
So instead of confetti, you get the whole scroll.
Yes. You capture the full-length isoform. You can see exactly which exons are included and which are skipped in a single molecule. You can see if exon 1 is connected to exon 4, or if it skips all the way to exon 7. It's been a revolution for understanding complexity.
A total game changer. And I understand we're also moving from smoothies to fruit salads.
Yes, that's the single-cell revolution. Traditional sequencing was bulk. You take a piece of brain tissue, you grind it up into a smoothie, and you sequence it.
So you get the average of everything.
The average. But a brain has neurons, glial cells, blood vessels, all sorts of different cells. If the neuron is splicing one way and the blood vessel another, the smoothie just shows you a muddy, averaged out mix. You lose the specific identity.
Single cell sequencing lets you pick out the strawberry and the grape separately.
Exactly. We can now see if a neuron splices a gene differently than a skin cell. And now we're combining long reads with single cell tech.
The best of both worlds.
It's giving us an unprecedented view of this Lego building process in action. We can see exactly which cell is building the car and which is building the plane.
And just to be thorough, the paper mentions they're using proteomics to check their work. Why is that important?
Yes, because just making the RNA doesn't mean it does anything. The cell makes a lot of trash, a lot of transcriptional noise.
So you want to see if the blueprint actually gets built.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Proteomics using mass spectrometry confirms that these weird alternative RNA versions actually get translated into real functional proteins. It proves they aren't just mistakes. They're the finished product.
Okay, so we have the tools and we have the concept. Let's talk about what we've found. What are the main ways evolution uses the splicing toolkit to change us?
The review outlines three main modes. The first is exon creation, or exonization.
Exonization.
This is basically turning junk into gold. Evolution takes a piece of non-coding intron, often a transposable element or jumping gene, and mutates it just enough so the cellular machinery recognizes it as an exon.
So a piece of gibberish in the middle of the text suddenly becomes a new, meaningful paragraph in the story.
Exactly. And because it was junk before, it's a great source of raw material. It wasn't doing anything important, so you can mess with it without breaking the organism.
You can test out new ideas there.
You can try out new protein sequences without destroying the old ones. It's a very low risk way to innovate.
Okay, so that's mode one. What's two?
The second mode is exon loss. This is the opposite. This is what happened with our tails. A constitutive exon 1 that was always there, always part of the final product, gets deleted or, more often, skipped.
The cell just starts ignoring it.
Yes. And the third?
The third mode is splicing level changes. This is more subtle. The exon is still there, but the frequency changes. Maybe in a mouse, an exon is included 100% of the time. It's constitutive. But in a human, maybe it's only included 50% of the time. It becomes alternative. That subtle shift can have massive effects. It's about tuning the ratio, not just an on-off switch.
I want to go back to that cis versus trans thing for a second. You mentioned a study involving a mouse and a human chromosome that settled a big debate. This seems important for understanding who drives evolution.
Oh, the TC1 mouse study. This is a classic experiment. It really gets at the heart of the question. Is the difference between a human and a mouse due to the machinery, the trans factors, or the genetic constructions, the cis elements?
So they put a human chromosome inside a mouse.
They created a mouse strain that carried human chromosome 21. It's a humanized mouse.
That sounds like something out of science fiction, but useful.
Incredibly useful. It allows for a perfect experiment. You have human DNA floating inside a mouse cell nucleus surrounded by mouse splicing factors. The question is, will the human genes on that chromosome splice like they do in a human, or will the mouse machinery force them to splice like a mouse?
It's a showdown. The mouse machinery is the trans driver. The human DNA has the cis signs. Who wins?
The signs win, the cis elements. The human exons inside that mouse spliced almost exactly like human exons.
Wow. So the instructions are baked into the sequence itself. The contractor follows the blueprint no matter who the contractor is.
Predominantly, yes. This implies that evolutionary changes in splicing are mostly driven by mutations in the sequence itself, in cis.
Which is safer, like we said.
Exactly. It's great news for evolution because, again, changing the machinery is dangerous. Changing one blueprint is specific and targeted.
But the machinery does evolve too, right? It can't be totally static for millions of years.
It does, but more slowly and often in interesting ways. Splicing factors like Novia or ESRPs are ancient. They are conserved from sea urchins to humans. But what changes is where they are used.
Like repurposing a tool for a new project.
Exactly. In a sea urchin, the Notii factor is used in the gut. In a fruit fly, it's in the salivary gland. In humans, it's absolutely critical for the brain. Same tool, different job site.
And sometimes the tool itself gets an upgrade?
Yes. There's a fascinating case with factors called SRRM3 and SRRM4. They acquired a specific domain called EMAKE, early invertebrate evolution. This upgrade allowed them to recognize tiny, tiny exons called microexons.
How small is a microexon?
Sometimes just 3 to 15 nucleotides.
That's 1 to 5 amino acids, a tiny blip.
A tiny blip. But these microexons are critical for neurodevelopment. They fine-tune protein interactions in the synapse. Without that tool upgrade, our brains wouldn't wire up correctly.
It's amazing that something so small can be so important. This leads into the playground hypothesis mentioned in the paper. I really like this idea because it explains how evolution can take risks.
It's a beautiful concept. Evolution needs a way to experiment. If you mutate a vital gene, the organism usually dies. That's bad for evolution.
Right, a dead end.
But alternative splicing offers a safe space or a playground.
Because you keep the original version.
Exactly. The gene can keep making its main essential isoform, the car that runs perfectly, and at the same time produce a new alternative isoform, the plane. at very low levels.
A little side project.
Right. If the plane crashes, it's fine, you still have the car. But if the plane flies, then evolution can select for it and ramp up production over generations.
It's like beta testing software. You don't delete the old operating system, you just run the new one on a few computers to see if it works.
Precisely. And this is why that so-called junk DNA is so important. It provides the raw code for these beta tests.
Okay, let's get to the main event, the showstoppers. These are the specific examples from the paper that prove splicing isn't just noise, it changes bodies, organs, entire species.
I'm ready.
We started with the tail. Let's dive deep on that because the mechanism is wilder than I expected.
The tail loss. This was a paper by Shia and colleagues. It really shook things up. We talked about the gene TBXT. This is a crucial developmental gene.
In monkeys, this gene builds a tail.
Correct. Now, in the ancestor of humans and apes, something happened. A retrotransposon, specifically an Alu-Y element, inserted itself into an intron of the TBXT gene.
Okay, a retrotransposon is a jumping gene. It copies and pastes itself throughout the genome.
Primate genomes are full of them. About 10% of our genome is just ALU elements. Usually they land in an intron and do nothing. They are just ignored commercials.
But this one was different.
This time there was a twist, literally. There was another ALU element, an older one in ALU-S, already sitting in the intron on the other side of exon 6, and it was inverted, meaning its sequence was backwards compared to the new one.
So you have two matching sequences facing each other, bracketing this one particular exon.
And because their sequences are complementary, they acted like Velcro. The RNA strand folded over and the two ALU elements stuck together, forming a very stable stem loop structure, a hairpin.
And exon 6 was trapped inside the loop.
Exactly. When the spliceosome, the editor, came along, it couldn't see exon 6 because it was physically hidden in this hairpin loop. So it just skipped it. It spliced exon 5 directly to exon 7.
So the instruction for build tail was on exon 6, and it got skipped because the pages of the instruction manual got stuck together by these bits of junk DNA.
Essentially, yes. This caused the production of a specific isoform called TBXT delta exon 6.
And how do we know this caused the tail loss? It sounds like a just-so story. A good explanation, but how do you prove it?
They proved it experimentally. They used CRISPR to engineer mice to have this specific skipping event. They forced the mouse genome to skip exon 6 of its TBXT gene.
And the mice.
They failed to grow tails.
Yeah.
Or they had very short, stumpy ones.
That is incredible. A random piece of junk DNA jumps in, Velcros to another piece, hides a page of the manual, and boom, 25 million years later, humans lose their tails.
It highlights how fragile and dynamic our genome is. It wasn't a grand design, it was a molecular accident that stuck. Because, presumably, there was an advantage to being tailless for our ancestors, maybe for sitting upright or walking differently.
Let's move from the tail to the heart. This one blew my mind because it involves a completely different strategy and solves a huge physiological problem, the superheart.
This is about the gene TNNI3, which encodes cardiac troponin array. This protein is part of the machinery that makes heart muscle contract and relax.
Okay, so it's a fundamental part of the heartbeat.
Absolutely. Now, think about the heart rate of a human. 60, maybe 80 beats per minute at rest.
Unless you've had too much coffee, like me right now.
Even then, you're not hitting the numbers of a shrew or a bat. Some of these small mammals have heart rates up to 1,500 beats per minute.
1,500, that's not a beat, that's a hum. That is 25 beats per second.
It's incredibly fast. And there is a physics problem here. To beat that fast, the heart muscle has to relax instantly after contracting to fill up with blood for the next beat.
If it stays tight too long, a problem called diastolic dysfunction, the heart stops filling and pumping effectively.
So they need a high-performance relaxation system.
Right. In humans and larger mammals, exon 3 of this gene is usually included. It acts as a brake. It makes the muscle sensitive to calcium, keeping it ready to contract. When we need to speed up, like during exercise, we phosphorylate the protein. We add a chemical tag that effectively presses the gas pedal to override the brake.
So we have manual transmission, we have to actively push the gas using chemistry to go faster.
But moles, shrews, and bats, they can't wait for that chemical signal. It's too slow for 1500 BPM. So evolution did something drastic.
What did it do?
It removed exon 3 entirely.
They cut the brake line.
They removed the brake pedal from the car altogether. In these animals, exon 3 is either lost from the genome or consistently skipped via alternative splicing. The resulting protein mimics the gas pedal down state permanently. It allows for rapid fire relaxation, enabling that incredible heart rate.
So by skipping one exon, they turned a family sedan heart into a Formula One engine.
Exactly. And what's really cool is that this happened convergently. Bats did it one way, moles did it another, but the result was the same. Lose exon 3, go fast. It's a beautiful example of evolution finding the same solution to the same problem.
That is wild. It shows how splicing can solve physiological limits. Okay, number 3, the immune system. We've got decoys.
This is a great example of exonization making a new exon out of junk. The gene is IFNAR2. It's a receptor for interferon, which is a key alarm signal for viruses.
So when a virus hits, interferon is the signal that tells the cell, we are under attack. Activate defenses.
Right. But you don't want that alarm ringing forever. An overactive immune response is dangerous. You get inflammation, cytokine storms. It can be more damaging than the virus itself. You need to dampen the signal eventually.
You need a way to turn the alarm off.
Or at least turn it down. Enter the junk DNA.
Our old friend.
A primate-specific ALU element again. An ALU mutated into a coding exon. When this new exon is included, it changes the shape of the receptor protein. The normal receptor sits on the cell surface. It has a part outside to catch the signal and a part inside to ring the alarm. This new exon introduces a stop signal, creating a truncated version. It loses the anchor that holds it to the cell.
So it falls off.
It becomes soluble, it gets secreted and floats around in the blood, but, and here's the key, it still has the catcher's mitt part.
So it catches the interferon signal, but it's not connected to the fire alarm anymore.
Exactly. It's a soluble decoy. It floats around, soaking up excess interferon like a sponge before it can reach the real receptors on the cells. It dampens the immune response to prevent overreaction.
So primates evolved a way to chill out their immune system using a jumping gene.
Yes. And there's a similar story with IL-13Ra1, another immune receptor. It seems the immune system loves using these decoy isoforms to fine-tune sensitivity. It's not an on-off switch, it's a dimmer switch created by splicing.
That is so clever. Evolution is a genius.
Or a very persistent tinkerer. It finds what works.
A tinkerer with unlimited time and a giant box of spare parts. Okay, last case study, the brain. And this one connects to something a lot of people worry about. Alzheimer's.
Yes, the MAPT gene, which produces the tau protein. We know tau clumps up into those famous tangles in Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
But naturally, tau is crucial for stabilizing microtubules, the skeleton of the neuron. Think of microtubules as the train tracks that transport supplies up and down the long axon of a nerve cell. Tau is the railroad tie holding the tracks together.
Got it. A critical job.
Very critical. Yep. Now, the MAPT gene has a very famous exon 10. Famous to us nerds, anyway. Whether you include or skip exon 10 determines whether tau protein has 3 binding repeats, 3R, or 4 binding repeats, 4R.
3R versus 4R. What's the functional difference between those two isoforms?
4R bends tighter to the microtubules. It makes the tracks very rigid and stable. 3R is looser, allowing for more plasticity, more flexibility in the track.
And you need both.
A healthy human brain needs a very specific balance of these two, roughly 50-50.
Perfectly balanced, as all things should be.
If you throw off that balance, if you have too much 4R or too much 3R, the tracks destabilize, you get neurodegeneration, you get a whole class of diseases called tauopathies.
So how did evolution handle this delicate balance?
Humans seem to have fine-tuned this balance to a higher degree than other primates. The paper discusses how we acquired mutations that weakened a binding site for a splicing factor called MBNL near exon 10.
By weakening the magnet for this factor, we changed how often it bound.
Right, and that shifted the splicing ratios to get that precise 50-50 balance required for our complex, long-lived neuronal architecture.
So it wasn't about inventing a new tau protein. It was about tweaking the ratio of the two existing versions to make the brain more stable and perhaps more complex.
Exactly. It suggests that our brain complexity relies on these subtle quantitative shifts in splicing, not just new genes for smartness. We didn't get a smart gene, we just tuned the instrument we already had better.
This brings us to the discussion section. We've seen tails, hearts, immunity, brains. What does this all mean for the big picture of evolution?
It forces us to completely rethink junk DNA. For years, we dismissed keys, transposable elements, and introns as garbage. Evolutionary debris.
The stuff we just had to carry around.
But this paper, and the research it summarizes, argues they are a reservoir.
The parts bin.
A parts bin, a scrapyard of potential parts. They are sequences that are almost exons, they just need one or two mutations. A splice site here, an enhancer there, and suddenly they're exonized. They become part of the protein.
It explains why we have so much non-coding DNA. It's not a bug, it's a feature. It's future potential.
It's not trash. It's the R&D department. It's the raw material for the playground we talked about earlier. Without that junk, evolution wouldn't have anywhere to experiment. If every piece of DNA was vital, you couldn't change anything without dying.
But there are limitations here, right? We have to be careful. Not every splice variant we find is a genius invention.
No, absolutely not. And that's the hard part for scientists now. Distinguishing noisy splicing, just random molecular errors or sloppy machinery, from functional splicing, real adaptation, is really difficult.
Because if you look deep enough with these new long-read sequencers, you find weird isoforms everywhere.
Millions of them. Mm-hmm. Many are present at very, very low levels. Are they the beta tests we talked about, the early experiments, or are they just the cellular equivalent of a typo that gets immediately thrown in the trash?
We don't always know.
We don't. Just because it's there doesn't mean it's doing something useful. Proving function is the next big challenge.
And even with the new tech, it's hard to do this at scale.
Current long-read sequencing is still a bit of a bottleneck for massive studies. It's expensive, and the data is huge and complex to analyze. We can't yet sequence every single cell in a human body to find every isoform. Not yet.
So where is this going next? What's the future?
Spatial transcriptomics is the next frontier.
Spatial, as in where things are in space.
Yes. Right now, even with single cell, we dissociate the tissue. We turn the brain into a fruit salad, but we lose the shape of the fruit bowl. We don't know which cells were neighbors.
We lose the architecture.
We want to know, is this specific splicing event happening in the dendrite of a neuron in layer 5 of the cortex or in the cell body? Location matters.
Location, location, location.
Exactly. Understanding where the splicing happens within the tissue structure will help us understand what it's doing. And also, as we discussed with Kao, looking beyond binary changes. It's not just exon in or exon out. It's exon in 40% of the time versus 60% of the time. Those subtle analog shifts might be where the real magic happens.
It's the analog nuance in a digital world.
Beautifully said.
So we've covered a lot, from the C-value enigma to the loss of our tails. If you had to boil this down for someone at a dinner party, what is the take-home message?
I would say this. Evolution is rarely an architect that builds from scratch. It is a remodeler. It takes the existing structure, the genome, and uses alternative splicing to rearrange the rooms, knock down walls, and build extensions.
It finds new uses for old parts.
It turns a static code into a dynamic adaptive system. It creates a car, a plane, and a boat from the same box of Legos.
And that flexibility, that editorial power, is why we are here.
It's a huge part of the story.
I want to leave our listeners with a thought that came to me while reading this. We talked about how a single splicing change, an accident with two ALU elements, lost us our tails. We talked about how another one rewired our brains.
Right, small changes, huge consequences.
If that potential is sitting in our junk DNA right now, what else is in there? What dormant potential is lying hidden in your genome, just waiting for a single letter mutation to create a new splice site?
That is the question. Are we the final product? Or is there a super brain exon just waiting to be switched on in one of our introns? A super heart exon?
Maybe the X-Men aren't so far-fetched after all.
Just a few splice variants away.
Just a few splicing errors away from telepathy. Who knows?
Who knows? It's an amazing thing to think about.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Where letters shift and slide, we cut and sew the code, revealing doors we used to hide. Tiny exons pop like stars, new shapes that redefine. Is a form's hum their different tunes along the spine. Across the tree of life, the patterns cluster by their kind. Some changes live in the sequence, some wander from mobile lines. ALU small notes can find a voice, a fragment define. We call it the splice of life, where choices make a song, a decoy that calms the storm, a beat that mends a wrong, a skipped exon tunes the heart, a Tourette show re-sings strong.
colors of forms into view. Mass spec finds the bodies where those coded fragments do come true. Many edits keep the frame, some outcomes still unknown, but each revealed possibility becomes a clue, a tone. Cis changes open doors, transfactors rewind. The phenotype enthralls. This splice, a small conviction that rewrites how we feel, from immune decoy to faster pulse. The hidden parts reveal